Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently, so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Welcome to ModPath Chat, the official podcast of Modern Pathology, featuring interviews with authors and experts on the latest science, technology, and developments in the field of pathology. Your host, Dr. George Netto, is the editor-in-chief of Modern Pathology and the chair of pathology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Here's Dr. Netto.
Welcome to our fourth episode of ModPath Chat. Our guest today is Alan Borzak, professor of pathology at New York Presbyterian Weill Cornell Hospital. Dr. Borzak is an internationally recognized expert in the fields of lung cancer and interstitial lung disease. He's joining me today to discuss his recently accepted publication in our journal. The multi-institutional study that he's going to discuss with us today was one of the first to delineate the pulmonary findings in a large cohort of COVID-19 patients. Thank you, Alan, for accepting the invite.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity to share the work and to talk about it with your readership.
Wonderful. I tremendously learned from reading the papers initially and now in preparation for this podcast, and I'm glad we got this chance. So I guess here it goes without saying, what were the circumstances that led you to do such study, but can you share with us some of the insights on how this cohort came about, because I realize it's from the two, at the time, epicenters of the pandemic. So can you detail some of those?
So we saw our first case that was test positive here roughly mid-March, and it had a very unusual histology. As a result, I almost immediately reached out to colleagues to see whether there were cases that could be shared in sort of a multi-institutional way. And we did that through the Pulmonary Path Society. The Pulmonary Path Society put out an invitation of that type. And as a result, two people responded with cases, one Fiorella Calabresi from the University of Padova and Mary Beth Beasley from Mount Sinai. All of us were in the same situation. We were seeing new and increasing number of cases, but even in just verbal communication, we were seeing some similar findings and some different findings, and we thought this was an opportunity to collect consecutive cases and to share them among three members of the Pulmonary Path Society, really focusing on lung pathology.
I see. And incidentally, Dr. Beasley and Dr. Calabresi are also equal contributor to with you to the papers, just for the sake of disclosures. So, and how did the Can you tell us a little bit more about the design in terms of number of cases and breakdowns and what exactly you did and looked at?
So we began and continued with consecutive cases. In the beginning, what we did was we shared our initial cases through digital pathology and also through still images to, I guess, titrate our pathology findings to each other, meaning I might have been saying, well, you know, there's a lot of thrombosis, but what a lot of thrombosis meant was not necessarily the same to all the observers. So we did a 10-case sort of round robin that way using digital pathology to try to get our numbers sort of similar in terms of our scoring, which was semi-quantitative, but nevertheless, we wanted to make sure we were seeing and saying the same things. There were certain observations, for example, thrombosis, epithelial injury, which we were initially interpreting somewhat differently, but in the end, as the cases amassed, we became more in line with each other in terms of how we were scoring so that we could really do this in a more scientific and uniform way across three institutions where we really, even within New York, quarantined from each other.
Wow. And so all that was done digitally, and I guess the cases started to, unfortunately, accumulate in a relatively short time frame. What was the time frame when you closed?
So this is essentially an accrual of roughly a month and a half of cases. Oh. We did cut it off at some point because we really wanted to share the findings. We started to see some very consistent features, and we felt that it was important to really get it out there, considering we anticipated that this would not necessarily be isolated to New York and Italy.
And so in that, those 68 cases, so were these all full autopsies or, well, I know the focus was on pulmonary for this publication, but.
So of the 68 cases, 65 were full body autopsies. Brain autopsies, we were not doing at Cornell because of some of the limitations of our autopsy room and the use of the bone saw and concerns about spread within the laboratory. And so we did not do brain. Three of the autopsies were extensive lung samplings through a chest only incision based upon the patient family permission.
I see. And in terms of ancillary techniques, can you share with us some of the techniques that you use?
So, the different sites had somewhat different focus, but we did electron microscopy on quite a few of the cases. We did culture of lung and heart blood on many of the cases. At Cornell, all of them got that. At some of the other sites, it was more related to history, whether it was done. We did immunohistochemistry for spike protein and in situ hybridization for spike protein message. In all the Cornell cases, so the 23 cases.
And the RNA-ish and the IHC were developed LDT or at that time? I mean, because that's...
They were developed LDT. That is correct.
Wow. And for the listeners, some beautiful images. I refer them to the manuscript. Thank you for providing those. So I guess let's just briefly discuss what are the salient findings, and which at the time of this was, you know, early on, and not all of us knew, but still a lot of interesting findings. Can you share with us?
So. There are some of the findings that I think were consistent with what was coming out in other single case and single institution series. We were seeing ARDS or the acute respiratory distress syndrome. We were seeing thrombosis in the lung, but in other organs as well. What's distinct in our series is that we identified a large airway lesion, small aphthous-like ulcers in the large airways, which were consistent with COVID autopsies, which we were not seeing in other autopsies. Some of the images are in the paper. The ARDS was a curiosity for me because as we shared the cases, what we found was that while the typical sequence of ARDS is to progress to type 2 pneumocyte hyperplasia, fibroblastic proliferation, and perhaps eventually fibrosis, we did see those changes, and we saw those changes with increasing number of days of disease. But what was a surprise to me is that the hyaline membranes, that is the new injury, was persistent and still increased with days of disease. And so while in other ARDS, we would see somewhat of a more temporally heterogeneous sequence, in this disease, we were seeing new hyaline membranes alongside organized ARDS.
I see. So how would you explain that? Do you think it's just continuous injury or?
So in the throes of everything that was going on, we our explanation was potentially ventilator-associated injuries, secondary pneumonias. However, a large proportion of our patients never saw a ventilator. And we were still seeing these new injuries. They were simply unexplained simply from ventilator injury. And the culture results were not necessarily supporting bacterial infections. And so this is what led us to really push forward with the immunohistochemistry and in situ to really try to decide in an individual patient whether the new injuries were due to virus and persistent virus or whether it was really due to these secondary manifestations of, you know, treatment-related injuries that were inevitable in patients with chronic intubation or in chronic ventilation.
And I guess the answer was the virus.
So in the first 2 weeks, virus was present in hyaline membranes and in areas of new injury almost selectively. Mm-hmm. After 2 weeks, it was a more of a mixed situation. Some patients were in healing phase, but if we saw hyaline membranes in the later period, they were almost always associated with virus. And this went out to as many as 4 weeks after initial presentation. So within the first 2 weeks, frequent. Within the latter 2 weeks, in other words, at 2 to 4 weeks, less frequent. But new injuries were still associated with viral infection, even between 2 and 4 weeks.
Amazing. So much to learn about this disease. I noticed you did even CD61 positivity to map some platelets for microthrombi. Can you share with us some of?
So the first cases that we saw, we were perplexed by the eosinophilic material that was in the vessels because it didn't look like fibrin. It looked like a bland or what people might call a bland or white thrombus. That is, it didn't have an awful lot of fibrin in it. And when we first saw it, I guess our instinct was, is this an artifact? Is this truly a thrombus? And what we found, and the CD61 helped us confirm it, was that these are platelet-rich thrombi. And they are throughout the capillary bed, small vessels, and we even found them in heart and other organs. Of course, this paper focused on the lung. We used the CD61 as an adjunct, but we got to the point where we could recognize these thrombi without the CD61. And again, that was part of the refinement process that we kind of started out with. Some of us saw the same finding and didn't interpret it, in fact, as a thrombus. We thought that it was an artifact. And this was something that took some time, but we convinced each other in a way that they were real.
Interesting. And certainly, I know I've never used the CD61, so that's a very smart way of approaching it, and glad it explains. So what are the impacts, I guess? At this point, we all know that this is a more systemic, but can you explain some of the impact of your findings in terms of prognostication or potential therapeutics, and I know some a subset of this cohort you shared with me that was a subject of a second publication looking at the pathophysiology. So if you can share with our audience.
So seeing this disease as a disease of epithelial injury as well as disease of endothelial injury was very important to shaping some of the therapeutics and still is. For example, the distinction of persistent viral infection from secondary infections really does argue in favor of an antiviral approach, and that antiviral approach might need to be in place past even the first 7 days for in 2 weeks. There were blood, for example, anecdotally, the number of blood cultures being requested across of our hospitals increased quite a bit during this period. The number of positive blood cultures went down tremendously. So people were experiencing a neutrophil and white count elevation that was not associated with positive blood culture. And we do think that that's part of the unique immune response to this virus is that we're seeing neutrophils, and we're seeing neutrophils in a subset of cases more proportionately than we would in another viral type of infection. So that was an unexpected finding. We certainly would encourage the idea around anticoagulation as being a therapy, but unfortunately, it's possible that this type of thrombus is not really treated with standard anticoagulation because it is a platelet-rich thrombus, and the approach to platelet-rich thrombi might be different than standard anticoagulation. And in diseases, for example, like TTP, anticoagulation is not performed at all. And so we do wonder whether the anticoagulation protocols need to be examined carefully in these patients. And then I think so antivirals, anticoagulation, and we're still delving into the immune response. This is something that we were more descriptive in this paper, but the immune response is clearly going to be different in these patients, I believe, than in patients who survive it, for one, which is really the main limitation of the study, is that we're really seeing treatment failures, not treatment successes here. And it really emphasizes the worst of the disease, not the immense success that there was in getting patients out of the hospital alive. So that is one of the limitations of such a study. You alluded to a separate paper on neutrophil extracellular traps that came out based upon three of the cases that were here that in fact had a neutrophilic infiltrate and were our early cases. It was interesting that it almost seemed as if our cases progressed in the same way as the disease, in the sense that we saw early acute presentations early on, and we saw more subacute and chronic presentations later in the course of this illness. And it's interesting that those cases tended to come early in our series. And I don't know whether that had to do with a particular susceptibility of the patients who were ill at the beginning or something that is as yet unexplained. However, we do believe that that neutrophil extracellular trap mechanism is the one of the innate immune responses to this virus and is perhaps an important part of the immune response early on to viral infection.
Well, for those who are interested in reading that other paper, it's in JX Journal of Experimental Medicine, correct? JX Med?
Yes.
Well, thanks. That's pretty intriguing. Anything else you would like to say about this, and or in general about? I know this study by design was autopsy study, so long term, but as an interstitial lung disease expert, that you're learning beyond what this study about the disease that you can share with us, especially on the long term effects on lung.
Yeah, for sure that, you know, some of the patients definitely develop lung fibrosis here. Mm-hmm. And that lung fibrosis is obviously in these patients was associated with a negative outcome. But it's to be expected then that the lung injury in a subset of patients will lead to some degree of lung fibrosis. And that will have long-term implications for the survivors of this disease. What percentage of those patients is unclear. And that remains an open question. Two of the other situations that happened in a way independent of this paper, but in collecting this series, is that there were some patients who by imaging were felt to have lung fibrosis, but in fact it reversed and they improved. And so we do face this problem of at say 3 to 4 weeks after ARDS, is that patient going to require lung transplantation? Is that patient going to improve? That question is very, very hard to answer still. And it would be a wonderful future direction if there were serum correlates of disease that would improve versus disease that is now permanently fibrotic. And this is, I think, important work that has to be done because we did face this dilemma. And it's a moral dilemma of whether to remove someone from a ventilator when you feel that they have permanent lung fibrosis. If that observation is incorrect, you are then withdrawing a ventilator on someone who might have improved in the next 2 to 3 weeks.
So some of the fibrosis in your experience being reversible down the road and
or some of the imaging features that are being interpreted as fibrosis may still be fibroblastic proliferation that can be reversed. That's correct.
That's cool. Well, thank you again. For this was very enlightening, and I would like take the opportunity to congratulate you on your new role. We're going to be even more of colleagues now. You're the new editor-in-chief of Archive and Laboratory Medicine. So I look forward to our interactions on the two journals. This has been a pleasure to have you, Alan.
Thank you so much for the invitation and for the kind offers and congratulations.
Thank you.
Any opinions expressed in this podcast are the speaker's own and do not represent the views of Modern Pathology, Springer Nature, UAB, or USCAP. Your ModPath Chat host and scientific director is Dr. George Netto. Producers are Christina Crow, Amber Jackson, Dr. Sarah Jang, and Dr. Catherine Ketchum. Technical direction is provided by Kaminsky Productions, music by Mitch Neubauer. Thanks to the authors, reviewers, and editors of Modern Pathology for making this podcast possible.